Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. Joe Strummer and the Clash open our podcast today from London Calling. It's Chasing the Satellites. And we're getting more information about last weekend's crash of the Russian jetliner over the Sinai Peninsula of Egypt. And according to two sources who are anonymous, U.S. satellite imagery detected heat around that Russian passenger jet just before it went down. But the discovery doesn't resolve the mystery of exactly why the plane crashed. The infrared activity that was detected could mean many things, including a bomb blast, an engine explosion, or a fuel tank that exploded. One expert who was cited, an aviation analyst, said the heat picked up by the satellite indicates that there was a catastrophic explosion or disintegration of the plane. Doesn't tell us if it was a bomb or if anybody had a fight in the airplane with a gun. There's a whole raft of things that could happen. Now, what I'm fascinated by is that, in short order, since this tragedy occurred, U.S. satellite imagery is at least being identified. I don't know that it's been released to the media or the public. But let me take you back to the shootdown of MH17, the Malaysian airliner that was shot down over eastern Ukraine. And the United States has routinely blamed Russia or Russian-backed separatists for the takedown of that airliner. But we have yet to see any indication that U.S. satellite imagery will ever be released to help us get to the truth of why MH17 fell out of the sky and killed all aboard. So I find this fascinating, and I think the irony is worth exposing. The British government has suspended all flights from the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh after declaring that it believes that that Russian plane may have been brought down by an explosive device. A spokesman for Prime Minister David Cameron said flights due to take off from Sharm el-Sheikh to the UK had been delayed while security assessments were carried out. Now, what's also interesting is that Egypt's maximum leader, General al-Sisi, oh, we don't call him general anymore because he's the president, he's visiting London right now, getting cozied up to by the Cameron administration. And he issued a statement saying that the situation in Sinai, is under our full control. Hours later, fighters believed to be affiliated with the Islamic State launched a suicide attack against a police station in Sinai. According to the state news agency MENA, that's the Egyptian agency, the suicide bomber rammed a car laden with explosives into a police recreational facility in the provincial capital of Al-Arish, destroying the facade and several nearby cars. At least 6 people were killed and 10 were wounded. But keep in mind that General al-Sisi says that the situation is under his full control. So it's anybody's guess who's actually responsible. But I find it interesting that in this case where Egypt, which we claim is an ally, and Russia, which we're, you know, engaged in a new Cold War with, that we've decided that it's okay to share satellite data. But when we were trying to pin the MH17 incident on Russia or its allies, that imagery has not been available. Robert Perry at consortiumnews.com has been routinely pointing that out in his excellent coverage of the Ukraine situation. Meanwhile, Israel is taking some new steps. They have passed legislation with a 3-year minimum mandatory sentence for anyone convicted of throwing rocks. Not only that, in the case of a child or teenager, the law enables Israel to cancel national health insurance and other social benefits for the parents of an imprisoned minor. This passed on a vote of 51-17 in the Knesset, and this is just another repressive effort by the Zionist government in Israel to try to suppress the Palestinian outrage. And one Palestinian noted that the laws affect children more than others because they're a vulnerable segment of the population, and that there is a double standard at play because Israelis, including settlers and their children, throw rocks at Palestinians all the time without being arrested at the same rates as Palestinians. And, of course, the underlying issue is the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians, the ongoing occupation, the apartheid that they impose on Arab citizens of Israel and those it doesn't consider citizens. And we're seeing that the death in recent weeks, 73 Palestinians have been killed, including unarmed protesters, bystanders, and accused knife attackers. And 9 Israelis have been killed. That's your 8-to-1 ratio. And it speaks volumes. Israeli forces raided a Palestinian radio station in the West Bank Tuesday, confiscated equipment they said was being used to broadcast calls to attack Israelis. Not to be confused with the U.S. propaganda outlet Al-Huria, the radio station in the city of Hebron, was raided. And while the Israelis say that the broadcasts have been used to incite violence, the station's director, Ayman Kawazme, said that troops came at 2 o'clock in the morning, destroyed equipment, confiscated transmitters. He said, "This is a clear violent aggression on the Palestinian media. We did not incite. We just reported the Israeli daily crimes against our people in Hebron. They want to silence our voice." And in a little bit of good news, Israel has finally released Palestinian lawyer Mohammed Alon. He was hunger striking and was near death back in August. They suspended his sentence, admitted him to a hospital until he could regain some health. Then they sent him back to prison, where he then resumed his hunger strike for at least a couple of days. And he was held under administrative detention. That's no charge, no trial, and no date when you can expect to be released. He was in for almost a year, since November of 2014. And speaking of inhumane detention without charge or trial on an open-ended basis, I was mildly pleased and surprised to see this op-ed in today's New York Times under the byline of my California U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein. And Feinstein, who's been way too cozy with the intelligence community, has parted ways on detention and torture with the neocons that she so frequently has backed since 9/11. And I am glad to see it. She'll tell you things that I've been saying for months. Let me quote, "Seeing the facility firsthand," she's visited twice, "reinforces Feinstein's belief in the great need to close this prison, which has cost us billions of dollars and is a real threat to our national security. Simply put," says Feinstein, "Guantanamo is one of the best propaganda tools that terrorists have today. Our enemies use it to justify terrorism and recruit others to carry out violent jihad, and our allies continue to criticize it as a violation of the rule of law. It is no coincidence that the Islamic State dresses its victims in the same orange prisoner suits used in Guantanamo before conducting their ghastly beheadings. Our policies have allowed terrorists to cloud who holds the high moral ground." She then addresses the waste of money. The cost per detainee is 30 times more than that of the most secure detention facilities in the U.S. It's hard to justify spending more than $2.5 million per prisoner when it costs only $86,000 to hold him in the Supermax Fed pen in Colorado. And then she recaps the real facts here. that during the Bush administration, 779 men were brought to Guantanamo, all without charge. Over time, we've learned that many were simply at the wrong place at the wrong time and shouldn't have been detained in the first place. Why did it take you so long to say this, Diane? And she recounts most detainees, 532, were released by the Bush administration. Of the 112 who remain today, only about 10 have been convicted or charged with a crime. So she argues that we've got to get over this silliness that we can't bring these prisoners to American soil, as if being in a supermax prison on American soil is different from being in Guantanamo. So she calls to amend the defense authorization bill that the president has vetoed so that the 53 detainees cleared for transfer can be removed from Guantanamo. Second, Congress should lift the current ban on transfers to the U.S. And third, for the relatively few detainees who can't be tried because of a lack of evidence, now I don't support this notion, but we have no right to hold people indefinitely without charge or trial. Anyway, bringing them to the U.S. presents a more cost-effective option, says Senator Feinstein. Meanwhile, Britain is ramping up its surveillance powers. Now, this bill is under debate in the Parliament right now, a draft bill that would give the government the ability to find out which websites people visit, and the information would be retained for a year. It's unprecedented in detailing what spies could do and how they can monitor us. And similar to the way the U.S. moved the retention of the metadata telephone records of all of us from the control of the NSA to the control of the phone companies, Britain wants the internet service providers to save the data and be able to cough it up at a moment's notice, including which websites people have visited, but not the particular pages. So, they know you went to Ashley Madison, but they don't know whether you tried to date a boy or a girl. They know you went to Amazon, but they don't know what book you looked at, what product you ordered. I don't believe that for a minute. And they try to play down the fears of people like me, by saying that, well, there's no ban on encryption. There'll be a two-tier oversight system with a judge getting the power to veto warrants to intercept suspects' personal data. But this is just creeping and creeping and creeping so far and so fast. And there's a little bit of good news in the surveillance state. Coming from a guy I never expected to see, introducing a bill to require a warrant for the use of one of these Stingray devices. Now, we've been talking about Stingray for more than 2 years, but the corporate media just picked up on it this year. Stingray is a system used by the government, and the FBI has been pushing it out to local law enforcement agencies in the last couple of years. It simulates a cell phone tower. It requires all cell phones within a certain range to check in with it and to cough up not just the phone number and the location, but the serial number of the phone. They can access the voicemail, they can access your contacts. And Jason Chaffetz, who I think is a real radical loony, he is a Republican congressman from Utah, it took the revelations by the Guardian newspaper that the IRS is using Stingray to produce a reaction from Chaffetz. So yesterday, Monday actually, he introduced a bill which would make it illegal for Stingray technology to be deployed without a warrant by either local, state, or federal agencies. Now, this is long overdue and highly welcome. And despite the fact that it's coming from Jason Chaffetz, who's determined to shut down Planned Parenthood in a vendetta that's based on emotion and no fact, this is reasonable legislation that is definitely needed to preserve and protect our Fourth Amendment rights. And last week, I talked to you about the bill that has passed both houses. In the Senate, it's called CISA, C-I-S-A, and the House version has a slightly different name. And it is alleged to protect us from cyber criminals, hacking, and the kind of events that started a year ago with the Sony hack. Office of Personnel Management, Target. And I want to credit Natasha Leonard. She's an excellent journalist now writing for The Intercept. And she does an important breakdown. I'm linking to it for you in the show file for today's podcast. But she refers to CISA as a zombie. Because this is legislation that was killed when the Democrats controlled the Senate just 2 years ago. And at the time, President Obama was against it. And I think her analysis is very strong. I encourage you to read it. I'm not going to paraphrase every element here. But she notes, for example, the precise cause of the Sony hack has never been made public. Experts point to an inside job, but we've been told to blame North Korea and Kim Jong-un, when it's pretty clear they're not that sophisticated, or at least from what we know, they're not that sophisticated. The hack at J.P. Morgan was made possible due to an unupdated server. Office of Personnel Management attack related to weaknesses in system security. The Target hack was the case of a person installing malware, and Target security experts missed it. Not a single one of those hacks would be affected by this new legislation. But it does allow corporate interests to share your private information, what we're told is private, with the government in some... I don't quite understand how they think that's going to help them find the hackers. Why do they need my credit card number to find a hacker in Singapore, in China, in Russia, or in Decatur, Georgia? It's bullshit. And I commend Natasha Leonard. The only complaint I have is that in her lengthy analysis, she didn't touch on the other bad part of the CISA bill, which dramatically limits Freedom of Information Act requests in the national security arena and gives the Senate Intelligence Committee the ability to review FOIA requests when the agency is resisting. It's a really bad element of the bill, and people should be screaming about it. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And I'm afraid I don't have my handy list in front of me today, because in moments, as soon as I finish this podcast and upload it, we are going to unplug all the equipment here and move it across the hall. It's a big move into a different space, and I'm looking forward to it. It's been a little crazy to get into position to do it. But I have to tell you that I'm not sure I'll have a news and comment podcast for you tomorrow. If we get all the equipment rewired and we're able to do so, I will. I should be back up to speed on Friday, and I do have an in-depth interview that I should be able to post tomorrow. It's an interesting chat with a guy named Hal Nijvecki. Nijvecki, that's his name is difficult to pronounce. His book is called Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. And we had a great conversation about the disruption economy, about Uber and Airbnb, and the whole attitude that the future is something that we all have to strive for, even at the expense of very serious problems we face in present day. And I will be releasing that interview in the next 48 hours or so for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And if you'd like to help me out with the cost of my move, and we're putting in some new equipment and gear and stuff like that, I'd appreciate a new subscription, or if you want to make a contribution, that would be welcome too. Just visit peterbcollins.com, click the menu tab in the upper right-hand corner, then become a subscriber, and you can take it from there. Well, Bernie Sanders, running for president, has launched a new climate campaign bill. He is, he's called it the Keep It in the Ground Act, co-sponsored by him and Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon. The Keep It in the Ground Act aims at plugging one of the big gaps in President Obama's climate change plan, his continued sanction of fossil fuel extraction on government lands and, of course, offshore. And so Bernie Sanders wants to zip that up and say that we need to really move forward and not take this crap out of the ground. Merkley told reporters, "We need to drive this understanding that for us to be good stewards of our planet, stewards, we must keep in the ground the vast majority of fossil fuel reserves. So this is encouraging. The Obama administration did kind of back into a ban on new drilling permits in the Arctic, but that was after Shell gave up and said, we can't find enough oil to make this all worth it. And so they're kind of, you know, sealing the barn door after the horses have left, but it's better than nothing. And meanwhile, Hillary Clinton is making gun control a central issue of her campaign. She is talking about the number of people who die. And she says, we're going to make this a voting issue, just like the other side does. How many people need to die before we actually act? Well, I commend the senator on this, because as a gun safety advocate, John Feinblatt, noted, this is a marked change from 2008, when gun safety was largely avoided during the presidential campaign. And another wag says that, actually it's Martin O'Malley, Hillary's would-be challenger, who's polling at 1%. He's the former governor of Maryland. He said, I remember 8 years ago Clinton was laying herself out as Annie Oakley reincarnate, and this year she's a great champion of gun safety legislation. Well, I think that O'Malley is correct in noticing that shift. And what's the reason? Because it is Bernie Sanders' biggest liberal liability. As you know, Bernie Sanders doesn't have the greatest record on gun issues. He's voted with the NRA a couple of times. And he says it's because he's from a rural state like Vermont, where they do a lot of hunting and people love their guns. So I give Hillary Clinton credit for taking this issue forward. She's being more bold than President Obama has been. And if she can get some traction on this, I'm all for it. I do think that there is a point of diminishing returns, unfortunately, because in middle America, there are a lot of people who have very muddled ideas about guns and buy into the bullshit from the NRA that the answer to a bad guy with a gun is a two-year-old with a gun? No, I guess I don't have that right. This is pretty remarkable. It has been 66 years since the leaders of China and Taiwan sat down and talked to each other. And this coming Saturday in Singapore, President Xi Jinping of China and Taiwan's President Ma Ying-jeou will meet for the first time since 1949. Now, I don't know exactly what might come out of these talks, but Xi Jinping is kind of flexing his regional muscles there. And I think this is a very interesting opening on his part. And the Mr. Ma from Taiwan is termed out, so he's not really putting himself at great political risk. But I think that this is an important step forward. And if we can see some kind of a relaxation of the tensions along the Taiwan Straits, well, I think that is a good thing. There were some local elections, off-year elections around the country yesterday. And I'll mention that the last week or so, I worked on what's called an independent expenditure campaign. I work as a media consultant on campaigns where I really support the candidate. And a group of people approached me in support of Sheriff Ross Mercurimi in San Francisco. And I talk about Ross from time to time. I've known him for more than 20 years. He has he lost the election, and he was run out of office by a cabal composed of Mayor Ed Lee and a group of people sympathetic to the mayor's attacks on Sheriff Mercurimi. And it goes back to even before he was sworn in, he had an incident with his wife that was mischaracterized as domestic violence. That led to Ed Lee suspending him from the job, trying to fire him. But Lee was unsuccessful. The Board of Supervisors overruled the mayor and reinstated Mercurimi after about 9 months. So he's done a decent job as sheriff, but the San Francisco Chronicle was on a vendetta kind of parallel to Ed Lee. And the outcome was pretty lopsided, about 61 to 33% in this election. What's interesting that I want to share with you is California has recalibrated its laws that require more disclosure from these independent campaign committees. And when it's the Koch brothers and Big Tobacco or Big Oil or Big Pharma, I salute things like that. But what's interesting for me is that the new disclosure requirements in California for an independent expenditure committee, and by the way, mine was comprised of 6 or 8 individuals who wrote checks to this committee, you now have to put up so much verbiage on the screen of a TV or a web commercial that it can't be read. The rules are you put it up for 5 seconds on a 30-second spot, 10 seconds on a spot that's over 30 seconds. But the disclosure statement that I had to put on these commercials was 5 lines long. And there's no way you can read 5 lines in 5 seconds. And so in an effort to promote more transparency, they've actually made it more difficult for people to discover who paid for a specific campaign message. Also here in San Francisco, Airbnb put $8 million into a campaign to defeat an initiative ballot measure brought by local citizens called Measure F. And it would have put a limit on the number of nights per year, 75 days a year that you could rent out a unit. It would beef up enforcement and penalties. It would require that a unit be marked as a rental unit. And there are a few other clauses in it. But Airbnb spent all this money, and they prevailed. And I see this as a kind of return of the robber barons. Back at the turn of the last century, in between 1895 and 1915, we saw the rise of oil and steel magnates in this country. Railroad barons still had a lot of money. And they were able to use their power to buy legislatures, buy politicians, and that's where the initiative process came from in California. It was a reform measure launched by a guy named Hiram Johnson as a way of letting the people have power over corporate interests. And so when you can put $8 million into a local measure like Airbnb did, it's not surprising that they win. In Ohio, the state where I grew up, the Buckeye Land, people made the right decision yesterday, and they rejected a bad initiative, Measure 3, that would have legalized marijuana, but given control of the industry in Ohio to a very small handful of the people who actually paid to put this on the ballot. How different is that from the robber barons of the past? And it's nice to see that even people who support legalization in Ohio voted that one down. In Seattle, voters also in Ohio, they voted for an independent commission to draw the congressional districts, which could limit or eliminate gerrymandering in Ohio, and that's something I fully support. In Seattle and in the state of Maine, they bulked up public campaign finance rules, and that's not a bad thing. The bad thing that happened was that in Houston, Texas, voters repealed a bill enacted by the city council in May that was a pretty garden variety anti-discrimination ordinance. But supporters of the repeal said that the measure would allow men claiming to be women to enter women's bathrooms. And so they used the John's toilets as the reason to enable discrimination against gays and lesbians and others. And this is so insulting and just so goddamn stupid. And it reminds me back in the 1970s, I used to debate Phyllis Schlafly. And if you're old enough to remember her name, she was the leading opponent of the Equal Rights Amendment. She always talked about bathrooms. She was obsessed with the idea that a man might come in and use the stall next to her. And it is just so silly and juvenile. And it shows that people can be, motivated by the fear of someone else in the bathroom who might not have the exact same gender identity, And that appears to be what drove that passage. And finally today, I am really bummed because about 6 months ago, I went to a yard sale and I bought a couple of crab pots because last winter, my friend Rob Larman took me out crab fishing on San Francisco Bay just outside the Golden Gate Bridge. And in a couple of hours, we nabbed 10 beautiful Dungeness crabs. And so this summer, I bought a couple of crab pots. I was just about to order up my fishing license because the recreational crab season is supposed to open this Saturday, the commercial season a week later. But our Dungeness crabs, because of El Nino's warming of the oceans and some of the algae blooms that have started to appear along the West Coast, it appears that our crab population are toxic right now. They have potentially deadly levels of domoic acid. And this leads to vomiting, diarrhea, cramps, headache. Gosh, we're going to have to put warning labels on crab now. So we don't have the final word, but the start of the season is likely to be delayed, and it may be canceled altogether. And that, for me, friends, is a real hardship. Thanks for joining me for News and Comment. I hope to be with you tomorrow. We will find out. And in the meantime, I hope you'll keep listening and share my News and Comment podcasts far and wide. Hey, thanks for staying with me all the way to the bitter end of my News and Comment podcast. I'll be back with you tomorrow or Friday, conditions permitting.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.